Golf Smarter number 108 for January 8, 2008. How do you do that?
SmarterPodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.
Mark Frost on an incredible true story in his book, The Match.
This is Golf Smarter. Each week, we tap the minds of PGA and USGA course pros, architects, authors, and teaching gurus to provide you with tips, drills, insights, and advice so that you can lower your scores. Golf Smarter is brought to you by Edwin Watts Golf, golf's most trusted retailer since 1968. Here's your host, Fred Green.
Welcome, and thank you for downloading another episode of the Golf Smarter Podcast. If you don't already, you know that a free subscription to any of our podcasts ensures that you never miss an episode. If you do subscribe, thank you. Today, Kenny Nicholson of Edwin Watts Golf answers questions about golf ball performance in winter, GPS manufacturers, and selecting a new stand bag. As we approach February, excitement about the upcoming golf season starts to build, and nothing launches the inauguration of a new year more than the AT&T Open at Pebble Beach. If you're not familiar with its rich history, it was originally known as the Crosby Clam Bake, because in the late 1930s, singer Bing Crosby would invite Hollywood's elite to get away and play with golf pros and the day's top amateurs. The history of this event in relation to the golden age of golf, Hollywood, and West Coast golf architecture all comes together in a new book called The Match, The Day the Game of Golf Changed Forever. Our guest is the author, Mark Frost. Now, in addition to writing the book and the screenplay for The Greatest Game Ever Played, you may have also heard about Mark Frost because he was the head writer for TV's Hill Street Blues and co-creator and executive producer of Twin Peaks. Welcome, Mark.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
Thank you so much. This book, The Match, The Day the Game of Golf Changed Forever, is fabulous. Congratulations.
Thank you. I'm really glad you're enjoying it.
I really am. I'm not done, and if you tell me the ending, I'm going to smack you. But I need to know, first thing, if this wasn't covered by anybody, if the press wasn't there, and it was a secret among a bunch of people, how'd you get the photograph for the cover?
I actually used a time machine for that. I was able to find a photograph taken from the actual tournament, the Bing Crosby Clam Bake, a day later of the first tee at Cypress. So it's not actually a photograph of the match itself.
Okay.
It was the closest we could approximate. And it is the first tee, and I believe at least one of our guys is in the photo. I think it's either Hogan or Venturi.
All right. Now, before we go any further, I really, I'm going to just open the floodgate here and let you go. Can you please give us, without the ending,
yes,
but give us the full story. Tell us what this book is about. Tease us so we go out and buy lots of copies.
Well, it's about the greatest private golf match ever played on American soil. And if you're like most people, you've never even heard of it. The few people in the game are who know the history, aficionados, pros, they all know it. It's like Bigfoot. It's like an urban legend in the game, and it's talked about a lot and had been talked about a lot, and that's how I first heard about it, from Ben Crenshaw, who said, this is one of the great stories in all of golf, and you should look into it. And I'd gotten to know Ken Venturi when I was writing The Greatest Game Ever Played, and that led me to a series of conversations with him, and that led me into wanting to write the book. So the story is as follows, the setup is. If you read The Greatest Game Ever Played or saw the movie, you'll remember Eddie Lowry, who was Francis Ouimet's little 10-year-old caddy, who helped him win the U.S. Open in 1913 and kind of put golf on the map in this country. And Eddie was a very ambitious guy, as you could tell even at that age, and he grew up to become the most successful Lincoln Mercury dealer in the United States.
Mm.
To almost nobody's surprise who knew him. He just had that kind of go-get-em attitude. And by the early 50s, he's a multimillionaire. He's set up in business. He's on the USGA Executive Committee. But he'd always harbored this desire to try to find another great amateur champion, like Francis we met, who could win the U.S. Open or the Masters, which has now come along and become the second big, important major championship in our country. So Eddie used to go on the lookout for these guys, and if he found people he really thought could play, he'd hire them as car salesmen if they had the knack, and they would work on his showroom floors and his lots, selling cars in the morning, and then they'd go off and play client golf in the afternoon. And it was like a, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. They were able to make a very handsome living and attract a lot of business to his car business. And he helped them with their careers. And also, if he found some really good players, he would pair up with them on the weekends and play these big stakes private matches. And Eddie loved to gamble. He loved the action, and he made a lot of money this way. So about the mid-1950s, he's got two young guys working for him that he's convinced are the best he's seen since the days, the glory days of the amateur game with Wimette and Jones. And they are a fellow from North Carolina named Harvey Ward, who's kind of Lee Trevino before there was Lee Trevino. He's a playboy. He's a charmer. He's a naturally gifted athlete who never practices, and then just goes out and beats the pants off people. He'd won the NCAA championship in 1948 for North Carolina. He won the British Amateur in 53, I believe, maybe 52. And in 1955, he wins the U.S. Amateur Championship. So he's the real deal. Bob Jones thinks he's the best amateur to enter the game since he'd left it in 1930. And pretty much everybody agrees. So Harvey's in Eddie's stable. And the other fella is a young, at this point, 25-year-old Bay Area kid who'd been a golfer of incredible promise and won a lot of junior championships and had just gotten back from an 18-month stint in the Army when he went to work for Eddie as a car salesman. And his name was Ken Venturi. So Ken and Harvey really hit it off. They started playing best ball matches against people for Eddie and just on their own. And in the 3 years prior to this match, they had never lost. They'd played something, they figured, over 100 matches together, never lost a match. So come early 1956, Eddie, as he always does, gets invited down to play in the Bing Crosby Pro-Am, then known as the Clam Bake, the first big professional amateur golf tournament in America. Crosby really invented the genre. And it's become a huge cultural event now. People come from all over the country. It's starting to show up on television. It's a hoot, and everybody wants to play in it. And everybody wants to win it because there's a lot of dough and there's a lot of, again, a lot of side betting and action that goes on that makes it really lucrative. In fact, Eddie, the year before, won the Pro-Am with his partner, Byron Nelson. He and Nelson had been friends since 1937. So Eddie's right there in the middle of everything, and he's brought these two amateurs down, and he finds himself at a cocktail party on Monday night, the week of the Clam Bake. Kind of the kickoff night. And he's bragging to anybody who'll listen that his two young players will win a best ball match against any two players in the world. And his host, a fella named George Coleman, who's a fellow member at Cypress and Augusta and another big mogul and a very good golfer himself, takes him up on it and says, are you telling me your two amateurs, your two kids could beat any two players in the world, pros included? And Eddie stands his ground and says, absolutely, and I'll put my money where my mouth is. So before you know it, they've agreed to a tee time the following morning at 10 o'clock at Cypress Point, and Eddie's agreed to bring Harvey Ward and Ken Venturi, and this guy says, I'm going to bring a couple of fellas, and we'll see what's what. The next morning, Eddie shows up, and Harvey and Ken are there, and George Coleman arrives with Ben Hogan and Byron Nelson, the two greatest living professionals. I mean, it's the equivalent of saying you're going to bring a couple of college kids out to the first tee, and somebody drives up with Tiger and Phil Mickelson.
Yeah, exactly.
It's that shocking. In fact, Ken is so overwhelmed he has to go behind the clubhouse to warm up because he's too nervous to be on the range with those guys. No, that's the setup, and it's all true. It's all documented. But the good news for me as a storyteller is that the match that then ensues more than lives up to the billing. It's the greatest exhibition of golf between four extraordinary players that I've ever come across. I can't find a similar antecedent or any other match that even approaches it. Between the four of them, they shoot 27 birdies and an eagle. They have only two holes, and they in par. Everything else is a birdie or an eagle. No one team is ever more than one up all the way through it. And it's four kind of geniuses of the game playing out of their minds. And there's a lot of other kind of cross currents going on here. We don't think of it this way now, but in the mid-50s, amateur golf still could stand toe-to-toe with the kind of players it could produce with the professional game. The pro game had really struggled for a long time. It started during the Depression. Both Hogan and Nelson kind of went out during those years that you made almost no money in the pro tour. You barely were able to feed yourself. It was a hand-to-mouth existence. You drove around in beat-up cars from Texas to California to Florida. I think only on average the top five guys in the tournament finished in the money.
What do you mean by the money?
Well, just
what kind of money are we talking about?
I mean, to have any winnings at all. I mean, you might play, say, the Texas Open in 1945. In 1945, Byron Nelson won 18 tournaments on the PGA Tour. He won 11 in a row. He made $42,000 that year.
And that was huge money in 1945.
And that's, you know, in today's money, that's probably close to $300,000. But still, think about what players are making today. And all Byron wanted to do was raise enough money to buy a ranch to quit playing golf. He hated the life of being an itinerant pro. It wasn't until the 1920s that professional golfers were even allowed into the clubhouses of the clubs where they were working. They were the hired hands, you know. They were the second class citizens. So,
and they had to be teaching pros just to be able to supplement this.
To supplement themselves, and they usually had the concession of things they sold in their pro shops to support them. But they were paid almost nothing. And the idea of a pro who could be free of ties to a club and just travel around and make money was an unheard of concept until Walter Hagen. He was the only guy who really had ever done it. And then when the Depression hit and golf kind of collapsed, he became almost the only guy who'd ever done it until Nelson and then Hogan were able to hit it big. So there's this real division in the game between the pro player and the amateur player. And the amateurs have always been the kind of custodians of the game. They've run and founded and run the USGA. They organize the big tournaments. They tend to be upper-class people who play the game for fun and passion and excitement. And the pro game has always been kind of a poor relation in a way. And the amateur game at this point, within the persons of Ward and Venturi, are still clearly able to produce players of equal ability. And this is the only instance I've ever been able to find that's short from, you know, playing together in events like the Masters or open championships, which means that they're open to everybody, pros and amateurs alike, where an amateur team takes on a pro team. The amateur teams had tried to challenge in 1952 and 53. Harvey Ward was on both the Walker Cup teams, which were extraordinary. They actually tried to challenge the pros' Ryder Cup team to see if they could have a pro-amateur competition, and the pros turned them down. They said, the reasoning being, if we get beaten by a bunch of amateurs, what does that do to our ability to make a living? They felt it would cut the legs out right from under them. So there's a real rivalry between the two sides of the game. And as near as I can tell, this is the only time it ever really came to a head.
And you get a sense that Hogan really did not like playing against amateurs.
He didn't at all. He didn't even like playing with amateurs. I mean, he was a kind of irascible guy, and he was a perfectionist, and he took what he did very, very seriously. So unless it was, you know, maybe a big money investor who was going to come on board the Ben Hogan Company, he didn't usually go out of his way to be overly nice to amateurs. And oddly enough, the one exception, well, the two exceptions he'd made to the amateurs he'd met recently happened to be the two guys he was playing that day. Hogan had taken Venturi under his wing, and he just loved Harvey Ward. He loved his attitude. Hogan, being a kind of retiring and shy guy himself, had a real fondness for extroverts. He loved Jimmy DeMeritt, for instance, who was kind of the clown prince of the Pro Tour. And Harvey was very much in that mold, always cracking jokes and whistling and singing as he walked down the fairway and winking at the crowd and making him laugh. And then he'd get over the ball and concentrate for the 10 seconds he was able to focus his attention span and move on. So those guys all liked each other. Byron Nelson had been a mentor to both Venturi and Ward through his relationship with Eddie Lowry. And most interestingly, Byron and Ben had known each other since they were 10 years old. They'd caddied together at the same course in Fort Worth, Texas, and had come up in the game together. They were the same age. They'd traveled all through the Depression together as touring pros. And then Byron actually became the first of them to hit it big when he won the Masters in 37 and I think the PGA and the U.S. Open by the 1940. And at that point, Hogan, at age of 30, had never won a single tournament yet. So the competitive nature of the game, and I think Hogan's desire and drive to succeed, and Byron having already got there, kind of slowly drove them apart. So that by the time Byron retired from golf 6 years later, and during that time, he, by the way, never lost a head-to-head match with Ben. He always got the better of him. From that point in 1946 until this date in 1956, Byron and Ben had never played a round of golf together. So it's kind of extraordinary that they were persuaded by George Coleman to step out and play as partners against these two young guys. So that's kind of the broader background of what's going on between these fellas as they trudge down to the first tee at Cypress Point that day. And as I said, what then follows is absolutely transcendent and takes place on, I think, one of the most extraordinary golf courses in the world. And all that really forms the basis for the match.
Well, to me, there was so many side stories, or there are some because I'm still reading, there is so many side stories that give you glimpses into the history that, as somebody who has taken up the game in the last 10 years and just loves to go out and play and not really familiar with the history of the sport, you really paint a beautiful picture and give great substance to what was going on during which seemed to be, like post-World War II, a golden age of golf.
Yeah, it kind of was. There were a lot of great players who had obviously developed in the years leading up to that, most of them through the school of hard knocks. You know, the pros like Hogan and Nelson and Sam Snead, you have to put in that bunch, had all grown up poor. And for many of them, golf was almost akin to a sport like boxing, as a way out of poverty, at least a way into the lower middle class, to grab a paycheck. If you had no formal education, but you could teach golf and play a little bit, you could at least scratch out a living. The idea that a white-collar professional, a guy like Harvey Ward, who was a college graduate and had a degree in economics, going out on the Pro Tour when he could take a job as a car salesman, make twice as much money, sleep in his own bed every night, and not have to travel. Harvey said, if I'd had tried to turn pro in 1955, I would have had to win two out of every three tournaments I played in just to come close to the same income I was making off the course. And that's an important thing for people to remember and realize, that the rise of the pro game and the ability for these guys to make these what are now extraordinary livings is all built on the backs and the effort of all these early pros who kind of blazed a trail and made the early tour happen. And it's a shocking thing to realize that the last thing Harvey Ward wanted to do was turn pro, not only because he wouldn't make a living, because it would have disappointed his parents, you know, who'd put him through college. It's a very different world 50 years ago. And I wanted the book, it's, with all these books, the golf books that I've done, both the the greatest game ever played in the Bob Jones book, the Grand Slam. I'm always trying to look at golf in its broader social context. What's going on historically at the time these guys are playing? What is the game doing in relation to the broad social movements that are happening around us in our society? Because golf's a pretty good barometer for that. And the other great thing about the game from a storytelling perspective is that the game truly does reveal character. I mean, everybody says it builds character, too, and I think it does. But more than any other sport you can think of, that I can think of, watching somebody play or playing alongside them or hearing about them tells you more about that person than any other sporting event that I've come across, because the game's demands on you are so unique. The ability to be self-reliant and contained and maintain that even keel that you need to do at the same time you're keeping that extraordinary focus and concentration.
Well, the fact that you don't have a coach or you don't have a referee while you're playing.
Yeah, it's incredibly demanding.
Right, you have to be your own referee pretty much.
Yeah, you're expected to call penalties on yourself.
Exactly.
It's a game that demands a lot of you to play well. And I think most of the guys who've made it to the top of the game have been not just great players, but for the most part, pretty fascinating people, too.
Oh, absolutely.
So I've been lucky in being able to tell these stories and getting to know these people, some of them, you know, posthumously, obviously.
Yeah, yeah. Why is it that golf, I mean, you've alluded to it, but why is it that golf has produced such rich and dramatic events that work so well in literature? I mean, only, I would think that boxing and baseball do that as well.
Yeah, those are the three sports that tend to produce the best.
Exactly.
Writing.
I mean, football and basketball, maybe track and field, you know, but that was like a movie.
Yeah.
You know, the Jim Thorpe thing, but boxing and baseball seems to bring out the rich and lush writings that you're able to produce.
Well, I think that because the game is played, golf particularly, is played without a clock, without it's a different. It's not on a uniform field. It's played. Every course is unique, and because the interior life of what's going on inside a golfer is so much richer, you're not trying to react to something. You're not reacting to a baseball coming at you 95 miles an hour. You're thinking, what am I going to do to a stationary object, and how am I going to get it from point A to point B, and the unique challenges that the course and the conditions and the competition place in your way to make that a less than likely proposition. I think those are great obstacles. And also, when you put a player into the kind of pressure cooker of match play in particular, which has always been, I think, the most exciting form of the game to watch, you get into this unique mano-a-mano game of how can I pressure this guy into folding. How am I going to beat him? You know, it's not wrestling. It's like I can't take him down, but I got to figure out a way to do it with this club in my hand and with the ball as my proxy. And I think that's a fascinating arena to put two combatants in and see what happens. And so golf, I think, is a uniquely interesting sport in that regard to write about, because you don't need to worry about when's the next pitch coming. You don't need to think about there's only 10 seconds left in the game. It's about what's going on inside this guy's head right now, and how is he going to make the impossible happen. And the great champions, the guys who have just mesmerized us, from Bob Jones to Hogan to Nicklaus and now Tiger, what you're seeing at work is a really unique human being. And what happens in this game at the match is that you've got four guys playing at that level, with that level of skill, and all these really intricate and interesting relationships going on between them, all of which I go into during the course of the book. You also have the benefit of, this is because most people haven't heard of the event, it's unlike most sports books where you already know the conclusion. You really don't know what's going to happen.
And don't tell me.
And I'm not going to tell you.
And is the attraction for you as a writer or as a golfer?
Well, it's both, really. I've loved the game since I was a kid. I had a Scottish grandfather who used to regale me with stories about the game and, you know, the old country and how the caddies and the teachers and the architects came over from there to here to work for the rich people in and around New York City to build their courses and tutor their sons and daughters and how to play. And it's a really interesting history that's, again, quintessentially American. It's a story of immigration and assimilation. And as all those facets of the game that had been established in Scotland for 300 years are transmuted into the American version of it. It's a really interesting process.
I'm sure that your goal is not to be the story here, but for me, reading this, you've got, like I said, so much going on. It's so rich. It's so beautifully written. And you paint such beautiful pictures. I start thinking about you and your research process and what it took for you to do the research on this. How long did it take for you to do the research? And like, how much time did you spend at Cypress Point? You know, you'll go out to the Monterey Peninsula and you'll see people with easels and they stand there and they're painting all along. I can imagine you sitting there and painting with a pad of paper, but just writing words and the descriptions of the Mackenzie course creates and how it presents itself and how you use words to paint these pictures. What is your research process?
Well, it's kind of an organic process where I just simply start talking to people initially. And as I go, you know, as I come further along the timeline of these stories, I'm actually able to find more people to talk to. And in this instance, I was really lucky. I got to spend a couple days with Byron Nelson before he passed away.
Wow.
And hear all of his insights and memories and talk about the relationships. And I was able to spend a lot of time with Ken Venturi. And I think Ken is, you know, over 30 years broadcasting golf on CBS. Most people have forgotten what a great competitor he was. He won the U.S. Open in 1964. He won, I think, 15 or 20 times on tour himself. He was a top-notch player. And he also, I think, for all those reasons, had a kind of photographic memory and recall. And because he was the youngest of the foursome that day, and because these two older men meant so much to him, and I think as you read in the book, you see how deep and rich his relationship with Harvey Ward became. That day was etched in his memory. And as we talked about it over weeks and even months, he was able to recall every single shot.
Wow.
And then I was, you know, there's a lot of other, I must have talked to 50 people who either knew the principles or knew something about them or had some kind of piece of the puzzle that added to it. And then, as you said, there was no substitute for actually going to Cypress Point and playing the course and getting to know it and seeing the angles that they saw. The course hasn't changed much in that time. It's been really well preserved. And it's an extraordinary piece of real estate, and it has a great history of its own, which is in the book. And
how long did you take to do the research on this book before you were able to present your first draft?
I mean, you know, not full time, but I was doing other things at the time. But, you know, an interview here, an interview there. What was unique about this is that there was no public record of it. There were no written accounts in the newspaper. There were no sports stories, no photographs to look at. It was all about oral histories. And then it was I was kind of waiting to write it. It was just I was letting it sort of percolate. And then Byron died, not unexpectedly. He was 96 years old, but it hit me very hard when he passed away. It hit a lot of people hard. And I actually sat down and started writing the book the very next day.
Fabulous. Fabulous. Is this the way everything is being documented? Forget the internet, but just for every golfer out there, every angle of every step that they take, whether it's on or off the course, is being documented. What kind of impact is that going to have for writers like you in the next 25, 30, 50 years to be able to look back and say this was history? I mean, is there going to be anything to say?
Well,
it hasn't been documented already?
Well, there's a difference, I guess, between documentation and interpretation.
Yeah, yes.
It's the difference between journalism and history.
Okay.
Journalism, you're simply reporting what happened. It's the story of the day. And history, we like to look back and make sense of what happened and filter it through a context for understanding the people and the events of that time. And invariably, that take is influenced by whoever the writer is. It can't help but be. There's no such thing as completely neutral history. So it's being filtered through your own consciousness, and you're trying to apply as much, you know, integrity and fairness as you can to getting the story right. And then, you know, as a person who's a storyteller, you're trying to make it interesting for people. You're trying to tell the story in the best possible way, and that's a unique process to every writer. Everybody's way of approaching that challenge is different. I just have to use myself as a judge. I say, is this a page that I'm going to want to finish and turn to get to the next one? And that's something I try to ask myself on every single page.
But you also have a good perspective on that because you are in the industry. You live in Southern California, and you work in the television or movie industry.
Well, both. I mean, I've been doing both for years. I mean, that's where I began my career. I was on the writing staff of Hill Street Blues for 3 years. I created and ran, co-created and ran Twin Peaks when that was on in the early 90s. I've written a bunch of movies, and I still do that, you know, as a nice way to make a living. And it actually is a great complement to this solitary work of writing books. I'm working on my eighth book now.
Wow.
But I like to work in different mediums. I like to kind of let the nature of the story dictate which medium it's going to be in. And occasionally I'll get an offer to write a studio movie that is hard to resist, and you sit down and rent your brain for a few months.
Steve Martin had written a stage play and a book about this outrageous meeting of, what was it, Einstein and...
Yes, the... Einstein at the La Panagile.
Yeah.
Picasso at the La Panagile.
Right, Picasso and Einstein. And
yeah.
So you can see where he was coming from, but the fact that you had these players that had never played before together, and it was just such an outrageous thing, it's a story you would think that somebody could make this up.
Well, it's,
but you didn't.
Yeah, no, that's the great quote that Venturi gave me. He said, If this hadn't happened for real and I hadn't been there, I wouldn't believe it myself.
Unbelievable. Well, it really is an entertaining read. It's hard to put down. I wish you all the luck in the world with it. And if it does become a movie someday, I hope it's going to be very successful as well.
Thank you.
Congratulations, Mark. It's really a great piece of literature. And a great contribution to, as you talk about how golf can reflect what's going on in society. It teaches a lot about West Coast history, pop culture history of the time, and golf history. There was a recent headline in the San Francisco Chronicle that said, is Barack Obama the next, is he the Tiger Woods of politics?
Right.
And I thought that was such an interesting statement. But
yeah, well, you know, that's the thing, is that the game of golf right now has given us the most famous person on the planet.
Yeah,
he is the Muhammad Ali or Michael Jordan of his generation.
And you know, it's interesting. I've used those two names in the past as well, and I'll continue to use Muhammad Ali because, to me, Muhammad Ali in his prime, and I remember it, he was a global character. Where Michael Jordan, I'm not so sure he was global.
No,
except for Nike.
Yeah, and that way he was. And the game that game has become more global as a result of his
exposure. Absolutely.
But golf has always been and will always remain a worldwide game.
Right, and hopefully when Tiger is all done playing, he'll continue on the philanthropy and towards change in the world by using his name and his stature and the quality of his personality to move mountains.
I think that's a very likely probability.
Yeah, yeah. Mark Frost, the book is called The Match, The Day the Game of Golf Changed Forever. Congratulations and thanks so much for being with us.
A real pleasure, Fred. Thank you.
It's time to ask Kenny. Do you need informed answers about specific golf gear or have questions about what to look for when you're buying new golf products? Come on, sing along with me. Kenny Nicholson, technical specialist at Edwin Watts Golf, is here to help. Now, to submit your question to Ask Kenny, go to the GolfSmarterPodcast.com website and click on the button labeled Ask Kenny. If we use your question on the show, we'll send you a free Golf Smarter Edwin Watts Golf hat. Ask Kenny is brought to you by Edwin Watts Golf and EdwinWattsGolf.com, America's golf club. Hey, Kenny.
Morning, Fred.
How are you?
I am great today. How are you doing?
I'm doing just fine, thank you. It seems like we've turned the corner in winter a little bit, and we're starting to get towards golf season again for a lot of people. It's an exciting time. They're starting to play in the tour in the warm weather spots. Going to move back over here. This is all good news for everybody, isn't it?
Ask those people in the Midwest right now.
Yeah, okay. Well, I just want to give them some hope. Are you going to answer that?
No, I'm not, actually.
We appreciate it. Hey, let's get to the questions, because obviously your phone is ringing. You do have to get to some stuff here. The first one, it's an interesting question from Angel Duval in Reston, Virginia. He was playing recently in cold weather, speaking of cold weather, and halfway through the round, his score started sucking up, or as he says, going south. His playing partner observed that he had changed to a harder ball with more spin and that could have had something to do with it. So he changed back to a softer ball, and lo and behold, his scores improved again. What are the pros and cons of various types of balls? Advice for the mid to high handicappers, and what to play during the winter? Should you change your ball during winter time?
I think it's more of a mental block than anything. One, he says that he switched to a harder ball that had more spin.
Yes, and, he did say that.
Yeah, I don't. I'm not aware of a hard golf ball that has more spin than, say, a softer ball. One, you have to be able to compress the ball in order to create spin. It's like taking a rock versus a sponge. You know, one's going to spin more and one is not, obviously, because you can compress one. Winter months, to me, I typically play the same golf ball. What you find, though, is the ball's not going to travel as far in the winter months. I think it's more of an issue for him just to figure out, one, find the golf ball that he can play the best under normal conditions and stick with that golf ball. Don't switch in the middle of a round, and he won't have that problem.
I have to say that I've noticed recently, and I'm sure many people have beat me to the punch on this one, but when I play in the winter, the ball's not traveling as far in the air, and it's definitely not traveling as far on the ground. The ground's softer, the air's cold and thin, and so, you know, I've had to club up on a lot of shots because it's just not traveling as far, and then it's not rolling as far when it hits the ground as it does in the summer.
Yeah, well, you're in California. Here in Florida, typically what you find is you're going to get a little more roll in the winter times because the grounds dry out a little bit more. But,
okay.
You know, so your region's going to dictate a little bit of that, and especially with the rain that you've been having out there.
Well, I haven't been playing, actually.
Find a golf ball that you typically play year-round, and don't deviate from that just because it's cold or it's hot or what have you. A lot of people used to think you could put a golf ball in the freezer and it would go further, things like that, and it's all more of a mental thing. I don't think that you gain any advantage by doing anything special.
Hey, you know, you talk about California weather, and usually that means fires, strong winds, and earthquakes. That's three of our seasons. But the winds were so bad where I live in the past week with our storms that we had that the large fence that is, it's netting at the driving range that separates the first fairway and the driving range with those like giant telephone poles that holds up those nets, four of those poles blew over this week.
Yeah, I knew it must have been pretty windy, one, besides reading the fact that you had 80-mile-an-hour gusts, but I saw a picture of a guy surfing at the San Francisco Bay Bridge, which typically that doesn't happen unless you have some type of huge winds going on.
Yeah, at the Bay Bridge you don't. Right outside the Golden Gate, there's a lot of surfing, actually, at Ocean Beach. But yeah, on CNN.com, their homepage of CNN.com last week in the height of the storm talked about my neighborhood and the 83-mile-an-hour winds that were shooting down the canyons here. It was outrageous. Okay, now we'll go back to sports. Now done with weather, and we'll get to traffic right after this. Sean Lynch over in Kensington, Maryland, is in search of a stand bag that's sturdy. He has a lightweight one, but he wants one that's more sturdy with lots of features like pockets and lots of pockets that he can use almost as a cart bag in some ways. What's your recommendation?
I mean, there's a few out there. If you're looking for specifically pockets and organization, there's a Sun Mountain makes a bag that obviously has 14 individual compartments, and it is a stand bag, very sturdy with 8 different compartments. And then typically that's what you find with a stand bag, you know, because you're carrying it at an odd angle, your grips tend to get tangled up inside there. And when you try to pull one club out, you find that you're pulling two or three clubs out. So, and if you can't find a bag that has 14 individual slots for the golf clubs, at least one that has 5 or 6 different slots that have what they call full length dividers. So each one of those compartments that the golf clubs go into, there's full length dividers that separate those compartments from the other. So your clubs typically don't get as tangled as, say, they used to in the past when all you had was, no full length dividers, and all the golf clubs typically ran into each other inside the golf bag.
I hate it when my clubs get in, difficult to pull in and out. It gets frustrating. So individual dividers sounds like a wonderful thing.
Yeah, especially when you just hit a bad shot and you're having to pull the club out.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's one thing to shove the bag into the club inside the bag, but when you're trying to pull it out and it fights you back, it's like language changes. Definitely language changes.
I've been there plenty.
Yeah. Talking of cold weather, Lindenhurst, Illinois is where Mike Persky lives, and he writes to us. He wants to know about... We've talked about GPS systems. We've talked a lot about SkyCaddy, but there are other products that are out there. There are other manufacturers who make GPS systems, and he's not asking you to judge one or the other, but can you talk about the trade-offs of the different manufacturers of GPS systems?
They all use the same satellite systems. That's one thing that's important to note. So there's nothing different as far as that goes. What you have to look at, there are 3 or 4 GPS manufacturers in the golf business. Garmin has a GPS unit, as well as SkyGolf, who initiated. They were the first ones to come out with a golf-specific GPS unit. Leopold has another. They have a GPS unit, as well as one called Golf Buddy.
And there's iGolf. I know you guys don't carry it, but iGolf is another product.
Yeah, iGolf, just one that I'm not familiar with.
Yeah, I like it. I've used it, and I like it.
I can't speak intelligently about it. You know, Golf Buddy is one that actually preloads golf courses within a specific region. So when you get the unit, the region that you live in, it already has all of those golf courses preloaded. Now, you can, if you go outside of your region, you can load a different golf course. But for the most part, when you're playing in your region, all of the golf courses are already preloaded. That's a pretty neat feature.
Yeah.
Very, very user-friendly. SkyGolf is a unit that you actually have to go to their website and download the course from their website, or you can mark it yourself.
Right, but you're paying for subscriptions.
That's correct. And Garmin is another unit that you can download the course, but then there's no buttons. It's very user-friendly. All you do is turn it on and go to the golf course, and when you get there, it basically knows where you're at and gives you distances per hole. So the Leopold, which is one that we're not stocking right now, so I can't speak real intelligently about it. But there, if you look at the name Leopold, it's kind of like Garmin. They've been in the scope business for a very long time, so optics is their cliche, and they're very good at what they do. So that's one that I'll be anxious to put my hands on as well. I mean, it comes down more or less to personal preference, ease of use.
Well, I think it also comes down to a couple different features, like can you tell how far you hit your shot? And if you like to keep track of things like that, you know, it's one thing to go out to the driving range and hit the ball and go, hey, look, I got it near the 200-yard mark, or maybe even got it out to the 250 mark. But if you can mark your drive throughout your round and get a good average of what your distance is, or even what you're hitting your 5-iron or your pitching wedge, it just tells you more. So there's that feature, which some offer and some don't.
That's great. And to me, that's an awesome feature.
Just, I love that feature.
You know, you're standing at the driving range, and who knows if the tee markers that you're hitting from, if they've moved them 5 or 10 yards from where they were the previous day, and you're still hitting to the 150-yard marker. You know, on one day and the next day, you're not hitting the same club quite that far. It's good to know exactly how far you hit every club on pure shots. That way, when you're out there, it's not a guessing game. If you're 175, you know, are you hitting a 7-iron or are you hitting a 6-iron? You know, you need to kind of know those things. And the GPS system, some of them offer the capability to be able to mark shots. So basically, you hit a shot. There's a button on there that says mark. So you mark from where you hit it from. And then when you get to your golf ball, it tells you the exact yardage from where you marked it. So I think it's a terrific feature. And if you're going to use the GPS system to its full capabilities, you need to be able to do that.
All right. Well, that's great. Kenny, you know, it's interesting. The questions obviously during the season are much greater. We have a lot more. We still get in questions. That's no problem. And if you do have a question, we invite you to go to golfsmarterpodcast.com and click on the Ask Kenny button. And we'll do our best to answer your question. But it doesn't mean we're not going to give away good stuff. And right now we're giving away the Momentous Indoor Driver.
I think especially this time of year, it's a great item to have because it still is cold in a lot of places and it's going to continue to be cold for a while. And it is a terrific training aid. One, it creates muscle memory as well as helps increase club head speed. So it's a great gift for somebody.
All right, the Momentous Indoor Driver, it's valued about $90. It's on page 70 of the Holiday 2007 Edwin Watts Golf Catalog. So if you have the catalog, go check it out. You can read all about it. And to enter the contest, go to golfsmarterpodcast.com and click on the word contest just below the Edwin Watts Golf banner. Once you're there, fill out the shipping information and the verification code, then click submit. Also, we still have the drawing for the Sky Caddy SG5. On the Golf Better at Edwin Watts Golf Podcast. Your deadline for entry on that is Thursday of this week, January 10th, 2008. So make sure that you go and fill out. It's the same process. Go to golfsmarterpodcast.com and click on the word contest. You'll see there's radio buttons, and you'll have a choice of the Momentous Indoor Driver or the Sky Caddy SG5. If you want to enter for both, you do have to enter twice. Okay, make sure that you are aware of that. Just because you enter for one doesn't mean you're entered for both.
Yeah, two totally separate contests.
That is correct. And still, as always, Golf Smarter listeners, Golf Smarter Tips listeners, and Golf Better at Edwin Watts Golf listeners all receive 10% off their purchases and free shipping when you go through the Edwin Watts Golf banner at golfsmarterpodcast.com. Thanks so much, Kenny. We appreciate your time, and we'll speak to you next week, bud.
Thank you, Fred. Hope your weather gets better.
Thank you. And thanks again to Mark Frost, author of The Match, The Day That Golf Changed Forever. I highly advise that you pick up a copy of this book and read it for yourself. It's a great story. And his writing keeps you engaged from the first page all the way to the conclusion. Now, the easiest way to purchase this book is on Amazon.com. And now we have a link right on our website. So go to golfsmarterpodcast.com and click on Smarter Shopping. Once there, you'll have three choices of books that have been featured on all of our podcasts at smarterpodcasts.com. Click on the golf-related books. You can choose the other ones if you'd like, but for this purpose, click on the golf-related books link, and you can choose from any book you like from the authors that we've met here at the Golf Smarter Podcast. Actually, we've made both The Match and The Greatest Game Ever Played available for you from Mark Frost's writing. So please, do me a favor, check it out, and then let me know what you think if you do, in fact, read the book. And if you have any comments about our Smarter Shopping site, I'd love your suggestions as well. Next week, Catherine Roberts of Yoga for Golfers will join us again to talk about golf fitness and conditioning in the off season. Please check out our new golf podcast, Golf Smarter Tips, and get updates on all of our golf podcasts on the Golf Smarter blog. Hey, I want to remind you one more time about the great offer that was provided to us from caddytips.com. Go to caddytips.com/golfsmarter and you'll receive 50% off all of your orders, and that expires on January 31st, 2008. This is a great offer and it's a great service. You can download courses from all over the United States, Ireland, and Scotland, and you can get professional caddy advice shot by shot for any of the courses that you download. caddytips.com/golfsmarter, a great service and a great offer that you need to take advantage of because it's only for Golf Smarter listeners. We close this week with a bit of golf history. On this date, January 8th, in 1938, the USGA revised the stymie rule. Have you ever heard of the stymie rule? You won't be able to imagine even playing without it. But they ruled that a ball within 6 inches of another that is blocking the path to the hole could be lifted out of the way. You weren't allowed to do that before then. Well, then in 1950, the stymie rule was removed completely, allowing us to lift our ball anywhere on the green, giving opponents a clear shot to the cup. If you have any questions, comments, quotes, or requests, please click on the Hey Fred button at GolfSmarterPodcast.com.
Hi, this is Michael Anthony inviting you to join me on the Golf Smarter Tips Podcast. Each week, I'll provide you with tips and insights on how you can lower your score using the Mental Keys unique mental training program. Are you having trouble taking your practice game to the golf course or making those pressure shots? Tune in and I'll show you how to improve your mental game and lower your scores.
Golf Smarter Tips Podcast is free on iTunes or at golfsmartertips.com.